Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Hunter Cheney with the Collings Foundation. The foundation is once again bringing its living history type exhibits to Valparaiso, bringing more World War II vintage fighter aircraft to the Porter County Regional Airport on August 5th. And some additions to that usual list of fighters will be coming along. We'll find out more about that, as well as find out where the benefits from that aircraft exhibit will be going. We'll also tell you from Lakeshore Public Radio, Stephen Lattimore, about folks who are not happy to hear that the Ultra supermarket in Highland is closing. Coming up on Saturday, August 5th at the Porter County Regional Airport, another chance to see some great World War II vintage aircraft with some new additions to the collection that you're going to get to see there. It's all part of a fundraiser being put on to help support the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, which is working in partnership with the Collings Foundation for this very special reception to see these beautiful planes and also benefit Northwest Indiana's first responders. And with us to talk about the big event, we have Hunter Cheney. He's with the Collings Foundation. Hunter, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Hi, thank you.
Well, take a moment here. Tell us the benefit of this big presentation is all about and about these great planes.
We have the National Wings of Freedom Tour aircraft that we'll be visiting. And this is a really unique historical aircraft tour. Think of this tour as a flying memorial, interactive memorial for our World War II veterans. And it features some very rare bomber and fighter aircraft fully restored from World War II. And that is the two heavy bombers, the B-17 Flying Fortress. Of course, most people recognize that plane from the old films like 12 O'Clock High and Memphis Belle. Mm-hmm. That's one of eight flying in the United States right now. And another four-engine heavy bomber, most mass-produced aircraft in American history, and this is the last one of its type flying in the world, the B-24J Liberator, big four-engine heavy bomber. And then the Doolittle Raid plane, you might remember the B-25 Mitchell. This is a very iconic mid-range bomber that was used by Jim Doolittle and the Raiders to attack Japan. That will be out there, and we have two fighters that will be there this year. A TF-51D Mustang. This is a kind of a rare two-seat Mustang, and particular to Valparaiso. And one thing that we're really honored to debut there in Valparaiso is a Spitfire Mark 9. And this is probably one of the most historically significant Spitfire restorations in the world, flown by two aces, 120 missions throughout the course of World War II, even flew its first escort mission to the 8th Air Force over in Europe, and many other very dangerous missions. And that will be out there for the first time in the United States. After our stay at Oshkosh, we're bringing it straight to Valparaiso, so the folks in Porter County and surrounding areas will have a chance to see a really rare fighter aircraft.
Now, take a minute, if you will, and tell us about all of the work that's been going into not only finding these great airplanes, but restoring them to operating status here, not just to see them on the ground parked, but actually see them in the air.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the core of the objective of the tour as a whole. Is what we say is that if you read about World War II history, it's something you might remember. But to experience something like historic aircraft from World War II, it's something you never forget. And the aircraft, all of them are just beautifully restored. And so these are a real functioning, the true Trulio fully restored aircraft. So when you're inside the planes, what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, aside from, of course, not getting shot at, is straight out of 1944. And so when the planes come in, you figure that for every hour of flying we do in all the aircraft, we put about 10 hours of maintenance into the planes. So you'll see that when we have them out there, we have the crew out there always constantly working on the aircraft, checking everything. they're such historical jewels that people from around the country come together for the sole purpose of keeping this tour flying. And this is how we've been able to do it for the last 28 years. We've surpassed, I think, 3,500 stops since we started.
Wow.
many years ago. And it's a tour that travels around the country. We visit about 110 cities every year. And it's through this real, just a grit and determination and love of what these aircraft represent that keeps them flying. And so when people come out, you pay the $15 to tour through the aircraft, or you pay to go flying in them. It is, in essence, each individual in each city that we visit that helps keep this tour flying, keeps the tour going. And that's the challenge that we're all faced with now, particularly since we're seeing this beloved generation starting to pass, is how do we remember World War II? How do we remember our World War II veterans and what they did, their stories and legacies? And there's no more effective means to do that than having people come and see and feel a tactile interaction with something from this era.
We're talking with Hunter Cheney, who is with the Collings Foundation, which, by the way, is a 501c3 program that has been set up to organize and support living history events like the one that you get to see on August 5th at the Porter County Regional Airport. These are World War II vintage aircraft coming in, being flown in, and in turn landing there on the airport strip. Tell us, Cheney, we mentioned briefly here about the work that's underway, I guess, in finding these planes and restoring them. When you're talking about a plane that is now more than 70 years old, there's probably a lot of difficulty in finding some parts to keep these things up. We're the crews that work on these planes that help them fly and get them on these tours, get all the parts they need to keep them up.
Yeah, so we have machine specialists from around the world and in the United States that help us in manufacturing and restoring essential parts that we use in the aircraft. And that includes everything from the special engine shops that help us fix the Pratt and Whitney's, and all the way up to special gauges and components. We have to kind of pull the expertise from around the country to bring the parts in and give them to our mechanics to help keep the planes restored. Keep in mind that the aircraft are American historical jewels. And so a lot of experts from around the country come and volunteer their time in helping keep these planes flying. And it's a dynamic group of people out there traveling with the planes day in and day out. It's we like a flying band of qualified gypsies out there.
I would imagine that probably you have a lot of Air Force veterans and maybe even naval aviation veterans that have been part of the teams that help keep these planes up and take them around.
Yeah, we do. They come from all walks of life, from retired military to professional pilots to just general folks who have a love for the aircraft. This tour really encompasses the full gamut of people with interests and expertise.
And it's so nice to have such a unique visit this time for this particular stop in Valparaiso, the Spitfire fighters. I've seen some of these World War II movies that have some of the replicas, of course, that the movie studios use, but actually get to see some honest footage of World War II, some dogfights, and that show these Spitfires really at work out there against the enemy.
You know, surviving World War II aircraft are unique artifacts from a conflict that truly changed the world. Now, World War II, of course, is the worst conflict in human history, and there are few left even at the end of World War II, and there are perhaps 100 bombers remaining over the 100,000 made by all nations, and approximately 500 single-engine fighters of the 250,000 fighters and attack aircraft produced by all sides still survive in one form or another. And of these fighters, you know, fewer than 5% are actual combat veterans, you know, ones that served, that flew in combat. Most planes that remain were either training aircraft or I'd seen no use in combat, mm-hmm. if, like a lot of the warbirds and some of the ones that were out on tour. A true Allied combat aircraft in itself is very rare, and this particular Spitfire has an intricately documented history. Again, 120 combat missions, which for those listening, it is a true rarity to survive.
Yeah.
30 at best. And each mission that this particular plane has is clearly detailed. And this particular Spitfire, you know, of course, flew escort on 7 of the first 10 U.S. Air Force missions over France. And it escorted raids that contained the you remember the legendary B-17, the Memphis Belle?
Yeah.
So it flew escort to the original Memphis Belle several times.
Wow.
And it survived, again, real strange twists of, you know, moved to South Africa and was up on a pole for many years and moved from one place to the next and then went into restoration and kind of stopped and kept going. And so the restoration process in its own lasted well over 20 years.
Wow.
And it was brought back up to England and to finish off the restoration. And this will be the first time in public that this Spitfire will be out. And so when people come see it, what you're seeing is this incredible history behind the aircraft. And that's basically what the whole tour is about in general, is it's not about flying old aircraft around. It's the history that they represent. And that's something we just love. They're just beautiful.
Well, that's great. That's a chance to see some great history of World War II, some fighting aircraft that'll be part of the collection that is coming on August 5th, Saturday, from 3 o'clock until 7 o'clock in the afternoon and evening at the Porter County Regional Airport in Valparaiso. And you can find out more, of course, by checking these out. Is there a website people can go to if they want to take a look at these planes, the pictures, and find out more about the tour coming in?
Yeah, absolutely. The great media and additional information can be found at cfdn.org. It's Charlie Foxtrot Delta November.org.
Hunter Cheney is with the Collings Foundation, which is the organization that helps put on these living history tours, helping bring these restored airplanes into Valparaiso this summer for the annual tour. And thank you very much for the information, and we're looking forward to seeing the planes come by here on Saturday, August 5th.
Thank you very much.
And that World War II aircraft exhibit at the Porter County Regional Airport is to benefit the MAC Foundation, which is a Valparaiso-based nonprofit charity that supports training for firefighters, EMTs, and law enforcement. This is Regionally Speaking on local, listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Employees and customers got the bad news they were hoping they would not have, that the Ultra supermarket in Highland, Indiana, is closing in several weeks. It's a stinging blow to workers and shoppers who, for years, had called this Ultra store their home. Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore talked to a business media observer, an affected employee, and shoppers about the closing.
Ultra Food has been in Highland, Indiana, since 1981. Joseph Pete is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana.
Unfortunately, the Ultra food stores in Highland and Kankakee, Illinois, are going to close after the bankrupt Central Grocers, their parent company, wasn't able to line up a buyer at auction. The Strachan Van Til had just done multi-million dollar renovations to these stores back in 2015, added sushi bars, added salad bars, expanded the produce departments, expanded the bakeries, added deli sections where they had like 40 more meats and cheeses. They pumped a ton of money into these stores. But then Central Grocers ran into financial woes. It has been trying to sell itself off entirely since December. It ended up where it was able to sell 20 stores to the Indiana Grocery Group, which is led by Jeff Strack and the Strack and Van Til families, former Strack and Van Til CEO Dave Wilkinson, and some other investors. However, they're only putting in a purchase for 20 of the stores. It did not include the Highland Ultra and the Kankakee Ultra, which are now closing for want of a buyer. The Central Grocers just requested in court that they be able to begin liquidation sales and start liquidating all the inventory.
Pete says once the closing sale begins, it could take a few weeks to sell off the inventory. For employees, it is a sad ending with the loss of good union jobs that helped create a good life for many residents here in Northwest Indiana.
Definitely, I'm afraid they're probably going to end up being laid off. I don't know. The Indiana Grocer Group has pledged to maintain the jobs it has at the 20 stores that will stay open, but I don't know if they'll be able to place any of the affected employees here. The Ultra has already laid off close. They had 15 stores. They're going to be down to just the one in Maryville on Broadway. There have been more than 2,000 layoffs this year at various Ultra Food, Strachan Van Til locations that Central Grocers has closed after its creditors pressured it into bankruptcy in May.
You know, it is what it is. You know, we've been knowing about this for a while now. It wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when.
What are you going to do?
Well, just what anybody do when you're my age, just look for another job and just go through the process of, you know, filing unemployment and going through trying to hopefully find another job soon. I just feel bad for the other folks that have been here for 30 plus years that have to start over now, no matter where they go.
Customers are surprised and saddened at the news. Many have been shopping here for years.
I'm disappointed because they have good bargains, you know, and it's a nice store. They just remodeled it like a year or so ago. And yeah, I wish they weren't, but that's the way it goes.
What are you going to do now?
Well, I have Van Til's just across the bridge from me, so I usually go there, Aldi's. But if I'm in the neighborhood here, then I come here.
Why do you like this store?
Why do I like it? Well, it has a nice variety of things. It's on my way home from certain places. And the prices are average. Sometimes they're cheaper.
Did you know this store is closing in a couple weeks?
No. Still, this one is too?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
What do you think about that?
Well, it's a shame because I used to go to the one on 165. It's closed. This one's going to close too.
Yeah.
But isn't Strack buying them? And
buying some of them, but not this one.
Not this one. Oh, no. Wow. Well, I don't like that it's closing, that's for sure.
In Highland, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Residents will have grocery shopping options, though, when the Ultra in Highland closes. There's a Strachan Van Til at Ridge Road at the State Line in Munster. And at Ridge Road and Calumet Avenue in Munster, there's a Jewel supermarket. And the Walmart at Indianapolis Boulevard and the Borman Expressway will be able to serve shoppers there. A new edition of Oddball Indiana, a guide to 350 really strange places, is now available, and its author, Jerome Polin, was with us on Originally Speaking not long ago to talk about some of the places in Northwest Indiana. Jerome says the second edition gave him a chance to talk about new places that he found and about places that no longer exist.
Over time, a lot of these places are very small. They might have two or three visitors a day. Some of them burn to the ground or someone moves away. And the more I learned about what had happened to the old sites, it needed a refresher. And the first book did very well, and people had contacted me and gave me ideas about new sites to go see. Mm-hmm. So it expanded from there.
I know that one of the places that had been in the first edition that is not in the second, but you note the fact that it's already gone, is here in Northwest Indiana, the Oz Museum in Chesterton.
Right.
That was pretty sad learning when you learned that one's had disappeared already.
Absolutely. But since then, they added a Orville Redenbacher statue in Chesterton.
That's
so,
right.
So it was replaced in a different location.
Let's take a look at some of the places. We'll start out first here in Lake County. One of the places that many people know about, it's been certainly the topic of trips and tours for a long, long, long time, has been the Marktown neighborhood in East Chicago. What got you the idea to check that out? Did somebody tell you about that ahead of time and say, you got to try and drive through this area?
Yes, it's sort of difficult to find because it's sort of wedged between the steel mills and some of the refineries there, and Marktown was a community that was devised by Howard Van Doren Shaw, and it was based on European architecture. But it wasn't exactly very practical because the streets are so narrow that people have to park their cars on the street. So my entry about this is, you know, park on the sidewalk and walk in the street. It's a very strange looking place. It's a little bit, long in the tooth, run down a bit. I had heard that they were possibly going to be expanding a refinery, when I went there and visited, for the second edition, still there.
I think that maybe the talk has just gone around the neighborhood. I'm sure the BP refinery would still like to claim some of the property, and I know it's getting dangerously close to the residents, which is one reason I think why they wanted to get if they do take over to, mm-hmm. to use it as expansion area for the refinery, they'd ask people to move out just for safety's sake, I would right. imagine. So,
but it looks like an old European village when you're driving through there, a little
rundown.
It's
very neat. The first time I think I ever heard about this notoriety was something that was in a Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Oh, okay.
Column that when it's actually his somebody or he maybe he Mr. Ripley drew a little depiction of what some of the streets in Marktown were like. It's very interesting to check out. The book talks about all kinds of things, and you have to take a look at the whole book to get the real feel. Even if you just focus in on the northern Indiana part of the book. There's a lot in here about cows, and that's not only about the new version of cows, so to speak, there at Fair Oaks Farm south of us here off I-65, but also some cows that have been hanging around for a long time. Tell us about the cows.
Well, every time that I ran across a fiberglass cow in the state, I added it to a list. So there's actually a list of I think about a dozen different fiberglass cows that you can find. I think there's one on top of Swiatek's meat.
Yes, right. That's the place that's on Broadway in Merrillville. That's one you see there right on top of there. In fact, it's perched right next to their sign where they advertise the specials.
Right.
That's one place too. And I know there's another one. I guess the Howard and Sons meat market on Ridge Road.
Okay.
And Munster is another place, too. That's another great place.
And as you're heading down in south on 65, mm-hmm. You'll see quite a few of them leading to Fair Oaks Farms.
Tell us, if you will, about some of the spots in Gary that you saw that were interesting enough that ought to be mentioned in the book, Oddball, Indiana.
Well, of course, there are the Michael Jackson sites from the Michael Jackson family. When the book first came out, there was no marker at the Jackson family house, which is on Jackson Street, but not named after the Jackson family. Now they have a large memorial that's out in front of this house, and you can also visit where the family went to the Jehovah Witnesses Kingdom Hall and the ruins of the old Lucky Lounge.
In Valparaiso, there are quite a few spots there that are noted in the book as well. We mentioned just one at the beginning of our conversation, the Orville Redenbacher statue. Mm-hmm. Who tipped you off to that?
That one actually was in the news. One of the things that I do, I have a file for every state in the union because I'm constantly putting out new books. So every time I hear some strange news, I will clip out the article or jot a note to myself and I'll stick it in the I'll stick it in the envelope or the file folder for each one. And when the Orville Redenbacher statue was erected, there was actually quite a bit of news in the Chicagoland area about this statue that was put up, and now it's in a park. It's downtown.
John Dillinger, the notorious gangster, who of course met his fate outside a famous theater in Chicago, also known too for his exploits as a bank robber with his gang in Northwest Indiana and other places as well, has a special section in this book. Tell us about the Diapers to Death tour, as you kind of put it in the book.
Right. He was born in Indianapolis, and so I trace everything from his birth in Indianapolis. When he was growing up in Mooresville, Indiana, which is southwest of Indianapolis, where he committed his first crime and ended up in the Pendleton facility, he asked to be transferred to the Michigan City facility because they had a baseball team, mm-hmm. and that's where he met all the gang members that would become known as the Terror Gang, doing bank robberies in the 1930s. I try to include as many confirmed Dillinger heists that took place within the borders of Indiana in the book as possible. And, of course, I also include the famous escape that he made from the Lake County Jail in Crown Point. Mm-hmm. And that is now open for tours. If you go to their website, you can find out the right times, and they're actually open. And then just in the courthouse across the street, they have the Dillinger collection where you can see the wooden gun and you can see the wicker basket where he was put in the morgue in Chicago, in the Cook County morgue, after he was shot outside the Biograph Theater.
Well, by the way, since this conversation, we've learned that we'll have the loss of another fiberglass cow because Piattack Meats in Merivale is closing. Oddball Indiana is available from the Chicago Review Press. Is it time to look at a new way to gauge economic success? That was the topic of a recent Counterpoint program on Lakeshore Public Television with Gerard McClendon and his guests, IU Northwest economics professor Steve Dunphy, Theodore McClendon of Art Science LLC, and Northwest Indiana consultant Matt Reardon. Gerard begins the conversation with a question.
Is capitalism still the king of the hill when it comes to the United States? Should we be looking at socialism or communism or a universal basic income? Or is capitalism just the thing that we need and should just last forever in this country?
Gerard, I am strongly in favor of capitalism, but I think there might need to be some constraints on it. And I was also interested in noting that we have to find a way to push it down to the lower level so that micro-entrepreneurs, not just big entrepreneurs, but the small guy on the street, the street entrepreneur on Broadway in Gary, might have a chance to sell his socks or his almonds without being pushed out of business.
This is interesting because when we think of entrepreneurialism and when we think of capitalism, we think of some big factory that has hundreds of workers and it takes millions of dollars to run the business. Theo, what do you think about Dr. Dunphy's proposal here? Capitalism and entrepreneurialism isn't just something on the large level, but it could be down to the street level.
Indeed, and I respect what he mentioned there because really for the average person on the street, they don't see the benefit of capitalism. They certainly don't see free enterprise at all. And so it will have to kind of gravitate toward just the average individual. Yeah. So I totally agree with that at this point.
Matt Reardon, we in the United States have a K through 12 education system. We get a diploma when we're 17 or 18 years old. Most American students don't have a clue. In a capitalist society, don't have a clue after 12, 13 years of school of how to start a business. I mean, should that model change? Matt, what do you think?
Well, you know, with the kids these days, and I'm speaking from direct experience, there's a money tree in the backyard and everything gets solved by that. So, you know, there's no correlation between how the stuff ends up at the grocery store and the means to purchase the stuff from that to who works at the store. And you know, to talk about being able to push down capitalism a little bit further, I mean, it's pretty basic. It's survival of the fittest, and that's the way it was set up. So you go back to when and whys of the United States, and I think that direction of capitalism was put forth because we as a nation wanted to be the best. We would provide the best product, and we would control the means of production and the means of profit in order to do so. And I think that panned out perfectly.
Yeah.
But now we're into, as we matured as a nation, we saw things like people figuring out how to work that system to control everything, Sherman Antitrust, and all those things that came about, people trying to control everything. So we did a little something about it. But now I think that, as the doctor pointed out, maybe we need to do something else.
Yeah.
And that should mean availability of resources to those that really want to do it, that were prohibited for whatever reason from not having access to it.
So, gentlemen, do we have a de facto bourgeoisie proletariat, to use archaic terms from Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto? Does that still kind of exist where there's this worker class that doesn't own the means of production and then there's this bourgeoisie class that owns the means and they can sell and we can buy? Does that kind of still exist?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But now you're looking more in terms of an ultra elite, the one percenters, mm-hmm. and the shrinking middle class. You see, and that's where the red flags come up now, because mm-hmm. when you can't earn a middle class existence just doing all the right things and, you know, working an honest day of work and all of those platitudes, when you can't do that because of lack of opportunity or because they're so top heavy, that's when it becomes problematic. Mm. And people are starting to notice that, and hence the outcry in the political sphere.
So how do we help Dr. Dunphy, the person who is, let's say, lower middle class or at the poverty level? Let's go back to your example.
Okay.
You're selling almonds and socks on Broadway. How or should we as a society even try to help that person? What do we do with that person who they've got an honest heart, they're a hard worker, but they just need a leg up?
I think we should try to help. And one thing I'd like to see is our fine Gary Police Department not drive in and ask the person, where's your license?
Oh, wow.
Did you register with the city of Gary? Are you, in fact, fully insured? I mean, we have to allow entrepreneurship to exist at this low level without going through all the hurdles that we put so many people through. And people get discouraged. They say, I can't do it. I quit. That's what I don't want to see. And I'd like to see more of these street entrepreneurs, not just the almond guy and the sock person.
Yeah.
But how about a lemonade stand, a hot dog cart? How about a whole bunch of people up and down Broadway in Merrillville selling little wares off of their cart?
Now, this is interesting because when you go out of this country, you see that everywhere.
Yeah, the bazaars.
In Jamaica last year.
And,
I mean, everybody was selling something. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't have to go to a large big box. It was right there, you know. But there seems to be some sort of, I don't know, maybe there's a prejudice or maybe there is some sort of atmospheric bias towards that street salesperson. Even though the person is being a capitalist, that person's discouraged from being a capitalist.
And it's conditioning, too. But you know something? Let's use the word. When you talk of capital, the real problem is access to capital, okay, in those neighborhoods. And just in general, access to capital. Case in point, it's so much easier to go to a car dealer and sign up with, you know, to buy a car.
That's right.
That might cost $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 when really... When really, personally, I would have preferred that I get a loan for $15,000-$20,000 for a pursuit that I'm going after.
Oh, wow, Theo.
But you see all of these new cars in middle class and lower class neighborhoods because they jockey it so the person can buy the car and be tied into that note every month. When really that person might have wanted to set up a better lemonade stand, to use an example.
Matt Reardon, why is that? So you can get a car note for 30 G's within a few minutes. And even if your credit's bad, they'll find a way.
They'll find a way.
Because they'll just jack up the interest rate. But mm-hmm. it's hard to get a $30,000 loan for a business where you probably can pay it back even quicker. Is that systemic? Is that on purpose? What do you think, Matt?
Well, let's go back to capitalism. So the guy loaning the money feels that by loaning money on an asset, the car, I have a better chance to recoup what I put out there over a shorter period of time than giving Theo, you know, 10 G's to go run his business when, I don't know, Theo doesn't have any assets. He's got a great idea, but I don't believe Theo, but I believe Ford Motors or whoever.
I disagree.
No,
I've got to interject.
Little finish.
But what I'm saying is that that's what the people loaning the money believe.
So collateral.
Right. True.
They say collateralized asset. That's why I'll give you the money. Giving money to me to say, hey, Matt, you know what? You're going to start up MCR. You're a smart guy, I think. You'll probably make a lot of money. I'd be happy to give you money. You know what? They'll say, you know what? Bring me your business plan. Now let's talk and think about all that.
Okay, I agree with. For a nebulous concept, I agree with what he's saying. If it's just a concept, mm-hmm. even though ideas are things, we know that. But I'm not talking for a nebulous concept. I'm talking about if I want to buy a $20,000 camera, mm-hmm. okay, mm-hmm. $30,000 in Klieg lights.
Mm-hmm.
That's still an asset.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I can't get that loan.
This is interesting. So, whew, Oh, man, you know
why
what?
Can't I get that loan?
So let's go back to the top of the chain. Now, who's selling the cars? Well, the big car manufacturers. Now, who invests in all those? Well, all of the, the retirement funds and the union people and all those government pension funds that go in to fund these cars. Now, everybody's got their money tied up in this. So the car guy wants to sell more cars. People aren't walking around with bags of cash to buy them. They need to be financed. Finance guy says, hey, I'll take the VIG. That sounds good to me. I can make a living. Then they take that money they made and put it back into the car guy.
Yeah.
So you know what? I'd say step up a camera manufacturer and get on that. It's a good business model. They seem to make a lot of money doing it.
Oh, indeed. And it seems like so. What I'm hearing from the two of you as we close this first segment out, Dr. Dunphy, it seems as if companies outside of the obvious companies should be allowing for money to be loaned for the cost of goods. Sure. Do you agree?
Sure, certainly. And one other thing I'd like to add is let's not forget the family. Dad has money. Mom has money. This is usually where the startup entrepreneur can at least get a beginning, because you're absolutely right. The bank is probably going to turn you down. You don't have collateralization. You don't have a track record. How do you get started? Go to your family. What does your dad do? What does your mom do? Can they help? Because they're usually the first person to go to.
Yeah. Scale seems to be an issue, too. We'll get to it more. So if I'm trying to if I'm selling cups, you know, I may be able to, you know, first of all, if I'm not making cups, it's too expensive to make a cup. I buy a cup from somebody else, slap a logo on it, and then I'd still own the business. But I've got to get that cup for a cheap enough price so I can sell the cup, ship it, still make a profit. But as Theo said, it still takes capital.
Exactly.
Hey, wait, before you get off that, so where do you buy the cup from? The American guy who makes a cup for a dollar, or the guy in Mexico makes a cup for 5 cents?
Oh, wow.
Well, now I'm going to buy it from the Mexico guy, because that 5 cents in Mexico seems to be a lot of money for the people down there working. Yeah. But when I get my cup here shipped for 25 cents, instead of paying $1.20 to get it manufactured here, now I have my cup and I'm able to sell it and my profit margin's bigger.
Yeah.
I don't have any workers.
I want to talk about working class, lower middle class, and upper class in the next segment, along with universal basic incomes. I've got Theodore McClendon, I have Matt Reardon, and I've got Dr. Stephen Dunphy with me today. Thanks for staying with us for the second segment, gentlemen. Elon Musk, all right, chairman, founder of Tesla Motor Cars and the Powerwall. He's putting rockets in space now. This guy is just a universal thinker, all right? His stock price is way up right now. He's got this electric car that's doing wonderful things. And then at the World Summit, he says that we probably have to implement universal basic income. He's saying that everybody needs to be cut some sort of check once a month or once a year by the government just to keep a system moving. One of the reasons he mentioned were that products are becoming extremely cheap now. That was the first thing. Mm-hmm. And he said that's because the robots are taking over. It's like a scene out of H.G. Wells or Time Machine or Kraftwerk. You know, what do you think? Theo, you talk about this a lot. Yeah. Universal basic income, man. Is this going to kill capitalism?
No, there'll be some rough spots, but it's actually going to enhance capitalism.
So what?
But let's talk about what the advent of this, okay, what even brings it about. It's because productivity is so much more efficient now. I was looking at a graph that demonstrated that in the year 2000 is when finally, productivity outstripped the need for workers. That was where they intersected, where the need for workers was going down and productivity was going up until it ultimately gets down close to zero. Ultimately.
We're headed there.
To be sure. And so let me interject this. Immigrants are not the problem. Okay. Mm. It's automation, AI, robotics. Mm-hmm. And they're not a problem. It just has to be dealt with. A new paradigm of understanding will have to be reached. Case in point, something that Elon Musk said at that summit and another summit. This was the TED summit with the president of TED. And So they're having a discussion about this semi-truck he's about to launch, right? Mm-hmm. This self-driving semi-truck. Incidentally, there's 3 million semi-drivers in the country. Mm-hmm. And he says, we're going to be able to take a semi-truck from a parking lot in the Bay Area in San Francisco and let it drive across country into a parking lot in New York City unassisted. Mm. And so naturally the announcer's saying, okay, well, how far is that down the line? He says, November. Oh, wow. Wow. This year. Wow.
Well, what Theo mentioned about the middle class, I was going to jump in that we when you have more efficiencies and you have these renaissance people like Musk that come up with these ideas, and we continue to drive innovation because that's how the United States got to be the United States. You know what? You don't need that employee because you have this automation that's occurring. And I hear people like, you know, boy, the steel industry has gone down. You know, it used to be 30,000 and now it's 5. And I said, yeah, because they got a lot of robots in there doing the work
yes.
that the 30,000 men had to do. So it's not any type of governmental regulation, in my view, and or any slight against unions or non-unions or any of it. It is the guy who owns the steel company talked to the man who had the innovation, and they got together, and the guy who owns the steel company figured out how to make more money by making his product more efficiently, safer, and quicker.
You know what, Dr. Dunphy, we got what Theo and Matt just said, I've got about 100 thoughts in my mind right now. And I always think about going from the horse to the automobile. You know, there were products that you needed for that. You needed saddles, right? You know, you needed gear for the horse's mouth. You needed bits. You needed a whip for the horse, all right? But once the automobile started selling, those items, people who sold those other goods pretty much couldn't make a living. What do we do with the potential worker who is already being replaced by a robot? Does our K-12 system have to change? Does our college system have to change? We're both college professors. Do we have to change in terms of training students for a massive robotic society?
Something has to change. I wish I had the answer, but it is a problem. I think Theo has thought about this more than I have, and Matt. And my question is, where does this universal basic income come from?
Yeah.
Is this the government is going to be giving everybody a check at the low end of society? I don't think that works.
Yeah,
We've had this problem before.
We have. And I've studied that, too, because I've definitely had those questions.
Okay.
Some of it will come immediately from the elimination of bureaucrats.
Okay. Mm.
Think of a whole welfare system. All of them will be gone.
Gone. Mm.
Okay. Another will come from an actual robot tax. The fact that the robots are so much more efficient, and they don't get sick, and they don't have daycare, and they don't...
That's true.
Isaac Asimov.
To be sure.
That's
you
true.
See?
Health care for the robots.
Right.
You see?
And they don't complain. I need more oil.
Exactly. And they don't complain.
Nope.
And so a lot of it will come from there. And then, because of the larger productivity, there will become a citizen's dividend. Citizens will benefit from this, a citizen's inheritance, so to speak. It's already going on in Alaska.
In Alaska, yes, that's what I was going to say.
Every citizen gets $500 right now per month.
Exactly.
Really?
So let me throw this out here. There has got to be a math equation that solves this problem. How much do we give away in social services on an annual basis? Mm-hmm. All right, now we know what that cost is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, get rid of all the overhead, as mm-hmm. you mentioned. Now mm-hmm. that's gone, and the money going out the door. Now I've eliminated half of that nonsense of the financial institutions that are engaged in any and all of that stuff, and a check shows up at your mailbox.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean you should sit home and not do anything.
Right.
That means you should keep working if you got a gig.
Sure.
But they're not going to discriminate against the guy who doesn't want to do anything, wants to sit there and not better himself or herself, and the guy who wants to keep going to work. What? Again, it's a math equation. So what is the answer to the equation?
It is a math equation.
And what are the incentives?
Okay, and this is where, because I've really been studying this, and I can see that math will have to be figured out,
mm-hmm.
and partially by what I said earlier about the citizens' dividend and the increased productivity, but also it's the fact that the other side of that coin, and the math is like $3 trillion
mm-hmm.
for everybody to get like $1,500 a month.
Wow.
Survival. What you're doing is you're handling the base of the Maslowian pyramid. So there's no starvation and no strife as far as that's concerned. But going forward, and the economists should figure out the math, but going forward, and where I think I come in, is there's going to have to be a lot more thinkers and philosophers to kind of allay the fears of people. Wow. And to let them know that maybe you have to readjust, you know, become good at a hobby, a skill, a gift, a talent that you can do in the meantime.
Charity.
And charity. And also use, that's when entrepreneurialism comes in for you. Okay, your needs are met. A lot of the fear of entrepreneurialism, the fact is you don't want to starve to death. Now you won't starve to death.
But does
you
that
create something?
You create something. But does the threat or the anxiety of your company not making any money and starving to death, does that give you greater incentive?
It does. But
to make a better product, to make a more efficient product, does the universal basic income take some of the ambition out of the equation?
Actually, no, and there's tests all around the world now. Finland, Denmark, India, even Silicon Valley has a test. They're about to pay some people $2,000 a month for 2 years.
Mm. Yeah,
they're studying what human beings do.
Yeah.
See, the sort of supremacist answer is, oh, they'll sit around and eat donuts.
Yeah,
that's what somebody would just say. But that's not what people do.
But isn't that what's happened? Isn't that the allegation of what goes on today with welfare and everything related to it?
Here's the difference.
They're saying, well, people are sitting on the couch anyway.
Because a lot of them have to bend the truth to get that. This is rich people and poor people.
Yeah, I get it. Across the board.
So this takes homelessness out of the mix.
It's
if you have a universal basic income, does this take homelessness out of the mix? And I'm coming to you, Matt, but let me go to Dr. Dunphy quickly here. With a universal basic income, what does that do for our almond salesman and our sock salesman on Broadway and Gary?
I would think it would kill the incentive.
You think so?
I mean, I started a small company. I was motivated. I was broke. I was on food stamps. I wanted to get off food stamps. That's one of the reasons I started the company. And I don't want a handout.
But what if the handout wasn't looked upon as a handout and everyone got this same universal basic income on a yearly basis and the stigma of it being a handout, that sting, was removed?
Indeed. That's a good point.
Indeed. And that's what the researchers are finding now. But what attracted me to this more than anything is the fact that it's not a left or right issue. That's what got my attention, because I hate left and right
it's
politics.
It's not political.
I think it's a myth. People as diverse as Martin Luther King and Richard Nixon and people as diverse as Milton Friedman and Robert Reich agree with this.
Wow. So I just got a few minutes left. I'm just thinking about this, Matt, in terms of art
science.
Let me get
to the other side of
this.
Now, people have money in their pocket. What do? They buy stuff.
Ooh.
So now I'm driving the economy because I've given people money to spend it to live. So they buy housing. So I need housing. They buy food because I need food.
Yeah.
All that stuff, the other side, all that nonsense that they talked about with trickle-down economics, except you start at the bottom and now you're bubbling it back up. You remove that stigma, and now people have money in their pocket. So what are they going to do? Now I have disposable income. I have usable income. What do? I spend it. So maybe I'll buy the almonds or the socks or the hot dogs as I'm cruising down the street, and maybe I won't have so many darn buildings empty. Not paying taxes, and all of that. So all of a sudden, I've empowered people to walk around and buy stuff. Now, doesn't that sound like a pretty good idea? And it doesn't undercut capitalism, because you know what? If I want to do it more efficiently and effectively in my building next to the other guy, people are going to come into my store and not his store.
Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon airs Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore Public Television, and it's rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock.
89.1 FM. Lakeshore Public Radio is your source for quality programming. Like any other nonprofit public media operation, we must have the support of our local community to remain viable. Local Public Radio serves as a resource during severe weather, a place for civil dialogue on important issues, and the place that challenges our thinking. Your individual support of Lakeshore Public Radio is absolutely critical to its survival. If you value Lakeshore Public Radio, then you must support it. Give a contribution today at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Local healthcare advocacy groups are tentatively celebrating the news that the Senate's latest healthcare bill is dead after months of protesting the GOP's plans to repeal the Affordable Care Act, though they're not calling it a victory, as we find out in this from Sarah Fenton.
Teresa Torres of the disability rights groups Everybody Counts and Adapt Indiana said she was on the phone with a friend when she heard the news the health bill had died after the Senate GOP lost two vital votes Monday evening.
So we both whooped. We both shouted with joy.
Last month, Torres protested the Senate's Better Care Reconciliation Act at Senator Todd Young's office. She was with a group of disability rights advocates who were worried the bill's cuts to Medicaid would threaten access to home-based services and community care. However, the two Republican senators who killed the bill by saying they would vote no were not swayed by the threat of Medicaid cuts. Instead, they said the bill didn't go far enough in repealing certain parts of the health care law. Torres says that's still reason for her to worry.
It's not actually a victory so much as it is a reprieve. We need to be grateful for that reprieve, but we need not to assume that it's done. You know, this was not a turning around of significant number of people who recognized, oh my goodness, this is, what are we doing? This is a bad thing.
Senate leader Mitch McConnell's Plan B, a full repeal without a replacement plan, also appears to not have the support it needs to pass. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sarah Fenton.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, it's Thursday, Reporters Roundtable Day. And with us will be Javante Anderson of the Post-Tribune, talking all things East Chicago, including the recent filling of a vacant city council seat. Carrie Napoleon from the Post-Tribune, Gregory Tejeda reporting on Gary News as well, and John Gard from the Herald Argus and News Dispatch for the latest news there involving LaPorte County government. That's all coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.